Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder, we Zoomed the day before. Before we get to our favorite guest on Friday, Scott Braddock, the editor of The Quorum Report, I want to remind you that we begin our show every single day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. He's been in the news recently, not for a good thing, again. One, he testified before the impeachment hearings of 2019. You will hear that testimony. Then he was walked out with his brother, I believe in February of 2020, of the White House. And now we have found out that he has basically sort of offered his resignation because the kind of pressure on him has been unconscionable. And he decided to leave. I hope that if Joe Biden becomes the next president, they find a place for Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. But nonetheless, listen to his testimony. Have it ringing in your ears, have it memorized so that when you exercise the franchise in November of 2020, you will know what patriotism sounds like. Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So we're Zooming now, you guys, which means I get to see my guests, what in some ways has been very, very exciting because you get these visual cues and you also sort of get to sort of see how they operate in the morning or in the afternoon, what kind of clothes they wear, what's on their wall. But when it comes to Scott Braddock, I kind of had a sense of what it was like. And so he held up this morning. Oh, look at this.
Yeah.
Look, what does their cup say? What does
so
the cup say?
I have a wide variety of mugs. I collect mugs, don't you?
Yes, yes. I collect mugs too.
You, Arnie, all the different mugs from all over the place with different things on them. This is a Brenham, Texas, Brenham Independent School District mug. It has the blue bonnets on it, and it notes the fact that the Brenham School District in Washington County, Texas, which is the birthplace of Texas, where the Texas Declaration of Independence was signed. In Washington County, they called it Washington on the Brazos. It was on the Brazos River. And at that time in American history, there were two Washingtons, and they were both important and thought of that way across the country. There was Washington on the Brazos and Washington on the Potomac. It notes on this mug that that is the first of all of the public school districts in Texas. That was the first one.
I cherish
this one.
This is why you love Zoom. But let me say before
that's
we
why
have,
you love Zoom.
That's right. Before we shush. Before we get into Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quorum Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the voice of Texas. Before we get into Texas politics, so here I'm looking at him, and he's got this huge cigar. I mean, we're talking huge. And I said, "So is this a Cuban cigar?" And that conversation led into sort of a little bit of a history, not only about the cigar, but also about casinos and about the mob. And well, so as he's telling,
and you love mob stories.
I do love mob stories. You know,
just
what?
You're from New York.
I'm a Goomba. What can I tell you?
This Long Island. You say Long Island with Long.
Long Island. Long Island. That's right. That's right.
We don't say
so
it that way.
I said to Scott, before we get into the real heavy stuff, this is actually a really interesting history lesson, and it was inspired by your cigar. So will you share what you shared with me just before we went on the air? Because I think I want people to know this. They never know when they're going to be on Jeopardy, and they may need it.
I want to recommend two books to you since you love these mafia stories. One is called Sharks in the Desert. It was written by a columnist from Las Vegas, the Sharks in the Desert, or the the mob bosses who created Las Vegas. And actually, the guy who wrote that book, when Sheldon Adelson bought the newspaper in Las Vegas, part of the reason was he wanted to fire that guy. because he didn't like the way he was covering the casino business. So that Sharks in the Desert. The other one is called Five Families, and it's about the big five families, okay, you know, that ran the mafia in the United States. And they basically had their own Congress. They would meet in Chicago. Capone would host them there. And, of course, they didn't like the fact that Capone was so, you know, well-known and publicized. You know, most of the mafia wanted to be under the radar and didn't want everybody to see their faces. So they didn't mind having him host, but they didn't like the fact that he was always out there in the news. This
sounds a little bit like Trump.
This cigar is called Five Vegas, and I'll be honest, I don't know the whole I don't know the whole history of this line, but it's a fine brand. It's good stuff. Five Vegas. It had me thinking about the fact that the mafia at one time was arguing about where they should base their casino operations, because, you know, they wanted to run casinos. It's well known that, you know, the skim at the casinos is how they would make so much money and take it, you know, in bags back to Kansas City or New York City or Chicago, the Chicago outfit. And there was this big debate going on: should they have their casino operations in Cuba, in Havana, where they did have casinos of folks from the East Coast, New York. It was very convenient, you know, to go down to Florida, then go to Cuba. And believe it was Meyer Lansky who had made the argument that they should base their casino operations there. And he was saying it's basically just like another state. It's real easy to get there, and you know, the laws are different there, and so we can get away with more stuff. But it was Bugsy Siegel who had been sent to the West Coast to scout things out. He was in Los Angeles, and he realized, no, we have our own little oasis in the United States called Nevada, where they have, you know, opened up the rules, and people can have casinos, there's gambling and everything. We should have our casinos in Nevada.
And legal prostitution? I mean, everything that any man could want.
Well, Siegel won the argument because... Well, he won the argument because Lansky was wrong about the fact that, you know, Cuba is not just another state. And eventually, you know, everything was shut down from being able to go to Cuba. I'll tell you one other thing about cigars real quick. There's a brand called H. Upman, which I'm sure some of your audience has heard about. It's a legacy brand. When JFK signed the Cuban embargo, the first thing he did that day was he had one of his aides go and round up 200 of the H. Upman Petite Corona, because that was the one that he loved to smoke, the Cuban cigar. He had 200 of them, and once he had them in hand, then he signed the Cuban embargo.
Oh, so, no, what a great story.
That's how this stuff actually goes down. But that's why Las Vegas is where it is and what it is now.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That was terrific, actually.
I love those stories. If you can read Five Families, it is just amazing.
Well, you know, someday we're going to have you on, and this is going to be like a random conversation.
We'll talk just BS.
Talk
all
BS.
Morning.
That'd be perfect.
You know, that's actually, you know, did we talk about, there was a great story, it was either in the Washington Post or the New York Times, one of the big two, about community radio stations having this resurgence because people really want to, you know, feel like they're part of a community even though they're stuck at home. Right. And I feel that that's going on with your show, Arnie. You have that relationship with your audience.
Well, I have some kind of relationship. I'm not sure what they think of it. Anyway, you sent me this incredible list, and you said, here are some things to kick around, Arnie. So let's start with the number one, because I just heard the CDC say that if there was mandatory mask wearing across the United States, we could really sort of break the back of this pandemic. And this then leads me into your first topic. With coronavirus cases skyrocketing in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott says the state can avoid another lockdown if all Texans will just wear a mask for the next month. Mm-hmm. Now, is this a polite request or is this a mandate?
It is a mandate, as you know, and we talked about on the show just within the last couple of weeks. The governor did a 180 on the issue. For months, he had been one of those liberty-minded, freedom-loving sort of Trump Republicans in his rhetoric in talking about the idea that government should never be able to force you to wear a mask. Now, Governor Abbott had tried to strike a different tone. He had been wearing a mask in public. He hadn't done that at first, but well before Trump was doing it, Abbott was wearing masks at his press conferences and anytime he would be seen in public, and sort of emulating what we had seen from Democrats who were always wearing the mask in public. Joe Biden wearing the mask in public. So, you know, our local Democratic county judges and mayors like Sylvester Turner in Houston always wearing a mask in public. Abbott had made that turn. And then he went ahead and said that he was going to fine people up to $250 per violation if you were in public in a county with more than 20 coronavirus cases, positive cases, which would be the vast majority of Texans at this point. We are an ever urbanizing state. More of our 29 million residents live in the urban areas than have ever lived in the urban areas before. And so, yeah, you're probably, if you're a Texan, you probably are required to wear a mask if you go in public right now. There are some questions about enforcement with that. Arnie, you have been tuned into this for some time because we've been talking about Governor Abbott and his interactions with the legislature and folks in Austin for a long time. Now, civilians are starting to figure out the way that Governor Abbott operates. And it's almost like you need a decoder ring. Look, he's one of the most brilliant legal minds. I mean that sincerely.
No, I know. He wants him to Supreme
He's a very good
court.
Lawyer. Very good lawyer. He was on the Texas Supreme Court. He was a justice. He was the Attorney General of Texas. And so when he chooses his words carefully, which he always does, you have to listen to them carefully. This is what he was asked on KPRC Channel 2 News in Houston last night. They because there's all these rumors. Are you going to shut down Texas again? Are we going to have the same restrictions in place? Are people going to need to stay home? Are businesses going to be shut down again by the governor?
You're an incredible hotspot. I mean, it's gone wild in places like Houston. I mean, they're bringing in ice trucks to hold the bodies. So
yeah, there was a headline. Bloomberg yesterday had the headline: Texas readying the morgue trucks.
Right. Exactly.
Because of what we're seeing in the spike in cases, the governor said, "No, that's not the goal." That was the quote when he was asked, "Are you going to shut down the state?" Quote, "No, that's not the goal." Notice his answer was, "No, I'm not going to." Right? He said, if people will wear a mask, then we won't have to shut anything down. Problem is, we have a lot of folks in the state who absolutely refuse to wear a mask. Part of that is because of the way the governor had talked about it for months. He had said the government should not be able to force you to wear a mask. President Trump has said things that would not just make you think, but he's basically said, if you're wearing a mask, you are somehow protesting his administration.
Right.
There's all the infighting within the administration you see now where they are trying to, some of the folks in the White House are out there publicly. Peter Navarro was in the op-ed saying that Dr. Fauci is, I like him, but he's wrong all the time. And you have the Lieutenant Governor of Texas, who I think was sort of floating that message out there as a trial balloon for the Trump administration just 2 weeks ago. Dan Patrick, the little governor, had said, no, thank you, Dr. Fauci. He wasn't going to listen to Fauci anymore. He said that he'd been wrong on everything. And then you see that message coming directly from the White House. So people are still getting mixed messages about this. You have seen various experts come out and say that if everyone would just wear a mask when they're in
public.
Head of CDC. I saw an interview on CNBC a couple of days ago. One of the business guys was saying, if everybody would just wear a mask in public, we could slow this thing down to the point where we could start to get past it. But people are not doing that. We will see what the numbers continue to do here in Texas. You see in Florida, they're having a terrible time right now with the coronavirus outbreak as well. And their governor has taken more of the Trump tact of just saying, no, we're not going to mandate certain things that people probably ought to be doing, but I'm not going to force anybody to do it.
So what I think is interesting is that while your governor is now mandating masks, he is getting a bit of an echo chamber. And the echo chamber I'm referring to is Walmart's decision to mandate that every customer now coming in wear a mask. They'll hand you a mask if you don't have one. You can buy masks at Walmart. And I think this is really interesting. I think as you begin to see more and more of big business begin to do this, it's going to make it harder and harder for people not to wear a mask because a lot of those not mask wearers shop at Walmart. Well, if they're not going to be allowed into Walmart, guess what? Oh, I'm going to be ticked off, but I got to wear a damn mask.
You ever look at the website People of Walmart?
No.
You ever see that?
Take a look at that.
It's a lot of fun. You'll spend your whole afternoon scrolling through that.
Okay, so
they call it doom scrolling as you're going through social media and you just scroll through things and everything just seems terrible.
There's such an education.
But Walmart, the people of Walmart will make you smile.
This is fantastic. So as we're talking about, actually, let me just ask one more question. Let's talk about the little governor for a second.
Yeah.
So Dan Patrick has been so poo-pooing Fauci and has basically said that people are expendable and this doesn't matter. We just have to open the economy and whoever dies, well, they're sacrificial lambs. Is he wearing a mask?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. The lieutenant governor has been photographed wearing a mask in certain places. I saw where he was He had shown up in the aftermath of a tornado in East Texas, and he had a photo op where he was wearing a mask. But then just a couple of weeks ago, as Governor Abbott was making the turn and starting to wear the mask in public every time you would see him and was promoting the masks more, there was a Tea Party event in the Houston area, just north of Houston, right on the Montgomery County line where Patrick actually lives. And he was there with Dan Crenshaw, who's a Republican congressman, and also Congressman Kevin Brady, the former chairman of Ways and Means. And none of them were wearing masks, and there was no physical distancing going on at a Tea Party event, I think up in Kingwood. It was the Kingwood Tea Party where they were. And so you just a split screen in Texas of here's the little governor, no mask, yeah. No physical distancing.
Exactly.
The governor on the other side wearing the mask and trying to hold things in line.
Well, let me just ask, I mean, has anyone served a Dan Patrick with papers saying he owns so much for the fines? I want to be, can I make a citizen's arrest? Can I? That's what I want to do.
Yes, you can. You saw those ladies who were very angry speaking in, I think, in California and in Florida, Palm Beach County, where they were going wild and saying that if they see people in masks, they were going to citizen's arrest these people because they're actually killing people with the mask somehow.
Well, anyway, so
I didn't follow it all, but I did watch it multiple times because I couldn't get enough.
Well, actually, there's a story on my Facebook page where some woman was not wearing a mask and the guy was putting his groceries into his car and he was wearing a mask. And she said, oh, that's so stupid. How ridiculous. He said, oh, really? You want a hug? I'll take my mask off. Let's hug. And all of a sudden she started backing away from him. And he said, oh, but I thought you said the masks were stupid. I'm taking my mask off. I'm doing exactly right. What you said. I think we should hold hands. And all of a sudden, so in a lot of ways, they're such phonies. You can just call them on it. Speaking of phonies, however, the Republican Party of Texas, agitated with Governor Abbott's coronavirus response, considers barring him from running in the next GOP primary. I mean, I need drugs to read this stuff. I just can't even believe it. What the hell is this about?
Arnie, I have to tell you that I love the smell of a Republican Party of Texas convention in the morning. Overnight, the Temporary Rules Committee at the Republican Party of Texas, they were meeting to come up with what the rules for the party are going forward. And the way it works is they have a Temporary Rules Committee, then a Permanent Rules Committee will then consider this, and then the entire convention could vote on
right.
it. That's the way it goes. So there's a ways to go before this would actually happen. But it is sort of stunning to some people. I was talking to folks in Austin this morning who responded wholly expletive when they saw that this had even been proposed.
I'm glad they think the way I do.
The governor, because of his coronavirus response, has now been formally censured by at least, by my count, eight county GOP executive committees around the state. This was a big point of contention when Joe Strauss was the Speaker of the Texas House. He was formally censured. Strauss was formally censured by the state Republican Party. But practically, the only consequence for that is that the party would not expend any resources to try to elect that person, the one who had been censured. And Governor Abbott does not need any help with finances.
He's sitting on more cash than anyone I could possibly imagine.
At last check, I think about $35 million in the bank. We were just going through their reports.
Yeah.
I think he raised about $7 million so far this year. So he doesn't need financial assistance. But these Republican activists are very upset with the governor. And remember, they're not upset because they think he's done too little to tackle coronavirus. They think he's doing too much. They say that the mask mandate is a violation of your constitutional rights. And so the Temporary Rules Committee at the Texas GOP adopted language that would say that one of the possible punishments for being censured by the party is that you would be prohibited from running in the Republican primary for any public or party office on the primary ballot while those rules are in effect. So if the governor was censured by the entire Texas GOP, under this scenario, he would not be able to run as a Republican candidate for office in Texas in 2022 when he would be up for re-election. Fascinating, Arnie. And look, if there was someone who was well-financed and wanted to take on the governor in the next go-around here, one of the ways to get him out of the way would be to do this. Now, I did hear from one Republican activist this morning who said that this was sort of all hat and no cattle, as they put it, because a candidate should be able to file in a primary as long as they meet the state law requirements for seeking office. But this is sort of uncharted territory. In 20 years of doing this, I've never seen the party do anything like that. They are so, I mean, they're more angry with Abbott for the masks. I mean, just to put it in perspective, they're more angry with him about that than they were with Joe Strauss for not passing the rules for transgender people to use public restrooms.
Unbelievable. They're suicidal.
Priorities, Arnie.
Well, no. And especially now that the Oklahoma governor has now contracted COVID. Yeah. I mean, I think what's going to be very interesting is to see how many GOP governors end up getting it. You know, I'm waiting to see what happens in Georgia. I'm waiting to see what happens in Florida. It's just shocking to me that they are willing to sacrifice their Republican leadership to prove a point. What's the point they're proving? That they're human and they can get the disease?
Look, the governor, and he, let me say this. The governor has an inspiring life story. When he was a young man, he was jogging in Houston in River Oaks, and there was a freak accident. A tree snapped, a giant tree snapped, fell on him, paralyzed him, and that's why he's in a wheelchair today. And in an interview yesterday, and the thing is, he has this inspiring life story, but he's not good at talking about it. He's not the most dynamic public speaker. He sort of talks through. He talks too fast when he's talking about it, and doesn't really emote. It's not in him to be able to do that, but he did talk about the fact, and it's the first time I've heard him say this during the pandemic. And it seems like something he could have said from the outset that would have made the case to a lot of people that they needed to do what they needed to do to help. And by the way, as I've made the point on this show before, when Texans are asked to do something to help, they usually do it. And that's been the case after hurricanes. It's been the case after school shootings, et cetera. Right. And so the governor was talking about the fact that if people would just wear a mask for the next 6 weeks or 2 months, it would be about the same amount of time that he spent in the ICU after the tree fell on him. And he said, you know, I wasn't able to get out of the hospital. I wasn't able to walk. I'm still not able to walk. But he said, I was able to rise up out of that bed and go on to have a career in Texas politics and become the governor who's sitting before you today. If he was able to really talk about that to people, I think he could really make the case in a way that would be very difficult for all of those folks who are on his right flank to really come at him in any way that was effective. But as for right now, they're sort of eating each other alive in the Republican Party.
Just shocking. Well, let's move to the other party then.
Isn't it amazing something can be shocking but not surprising all at once?
I mean, that's life under Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, too many things
are twisting ourselves into pretzels over what? I mean, you have the administration at war with itself, discrediting their own top infectious disease expert, who, by the way, served under how many presidents? Six presidents, going back to Reagan. Republicans and Democrats alike, and somebody who, has helped steer the country through some terrible health public crises, including the AIDS epidemic, Ebola, which we,
this is a new disease
in Dallas. This is a brand new disease.
We know.
So why don't you know everything about this? Because it's a brand new thing.
It's like why do you go to school? Because you know everything at age five? No, because you learn and you learn and you learn. And what we are is we were 5-year-olds when this pandemic hit, and we're learning more and more about it all the time, including now, you know, if you lay on your stomach, you may have a greater sense of survival than if you lay on your back. We now know that we don't want to put you on a ventilator because you're more likely to die. Think of all the things we have learned in real time, everyone. That's what's so shocking. And to say that someone is wrong because they're learning, that's wrong.
Well, they're learning in real time in front of us. It has become a sign of weakness in politics that you would change your position because you got new information, which would be the weakest thing that you could do. And I have often said to my daughter, when she makes mistakes, you know, she's 19 years old, so she's made some, you know, as you go through life, I always tell her, Arnie, I don't expect you to know everything. I expect you to learn.
Right. So let's end with this. Despite a pandemic coupled with the Texas heat, Democrats saw record numbers of voters in this week's primary runoff elections. So you said that you were going to read the tea leaves and explain how this happened and what does it mean?
Well, I'm not sure. We got about almost a million votes in the Democratic runoff, which is huge. The last time that either party exceeded a million votes in a July primary runoff. You have to go all the way back to 2012 when it was Ted Cruz versus David Dewhurst for the U.S. Senate. So you have a U.S. Senate race playing out right now on the Democratic side. Republican vote across the state was a little depressed, but I don't think it tells you anything about Republican voting strength for the November election, because there were some counties in Texas, Arnie, this week, where if you walked in as a Republican wanting to vote in the Republican primary runoff and ask for a ballot, they wouldn't give you one because there was nothing to vote on. There were no statewide ballot offices on the ballot. There were congressional runoffs from Houston to the Panhandle. So there were, I think there were something like around 500,000 Republican votes. So they were running in congressional races, or they were voting
no
in congressional races,
legislative
races, but they just didn't have things to vote on. On the Democratic side, you had MJ Hager, who is the preferred candidate of the National Senate Democrats, the Chuck Schumer's group. They supported her. And Royce West, who is an African-American state legislator from Dallas. And West started out at a serious disadvantage. National Democrats had already come out in favor of MJ Hager, who ran for Congress and almost beat a Republican congressman in a very Republican district in the last election.
She's
in
military history, am I correct?
That's correct. She's her rank was major. She was shot down in the theater of war. She has a very inspiring story of her own. And you know, Democrats nationally have sort of coalesced around the idea of promoting these moderate women to run for office, you know, in places around the country. But because you had this later entrant, an African-American senator from Dallas who gets into the race, just anecdotally and talking to people in Dallas-Fort Worth and Houston, San Antonio, and elsewhere, it started to seem that because the energy on the left and with the Democratic Party started to be centered on Black Lives Matter and, police reform in the wake of the death of George Floyd, that maybe a seasoned African-American legislator was more of the candidate for the moment. And so it ended up being, instead of a 15-point blowout like some people thought it was going to be, it ended up being a 4-point race, a competitive primary for Democrats in Texas, which I've said for a long time is something Democrats needed to have.
Exactly.
I mean, have a damn argument about what kind of a party you're going to be and what your party needs to be. For a long time, if you were going to run for statewide office in Texas as a Democrat, that was basically your retirement plan from politics. And so it isn't the case now. This is probably the year that Beto O'Rourke might have been able to get over the hump and win in a statewide race if he had to run for Senate instead of president. Democrats have all kinds of reasons to be excited. Republicans are demoralized because of where we're at with the president and with what I was just talking about with so much infighting. With the Republicans hating on their own governor, this is the way I've always described it. And one of my Democratic friends this morning texting and saying, man, are the Republicans really going to shoot themselves in the foot like that? Go ahead and censure the Republican governor, try to keep him off the ballot. And I said, the way I've always viewed this whole thing, at least the last 20 years, is Republicans always shooting themselves in the foot in Texas and Democrats still, for whatever reason, not able to catch up.
And on that note, Scott Braddock is the editor of The Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. You have taught us so much. Oh, is that another cup? I don't want to even look at you. What is this one? This one's got Batman? This is
I had some green tea ready to go in my Batman mug. Batman mug, because it's the Bat Cup. And let me tell you, the world doesn't save itself, Arnie. The world doesn't save itself, Arnie.
I got that. Anyway, Scott Braddock joins us every Friday. If it's Friday, it must be Braddock. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. When we come back, we schlep to Iowa. See you soon.
A super highway for aquatic invaders on this current cast. When locks and canals began allowing ocean-going vessels to bypass Niagara Falls, they did more than open new trade routes to the west. Suddenly,
things like sea lamprey and the alewives were able to swim around Niagara Falls and get into Lake Erie and then the upper Great Lakes, too.
Tim Campbell of the University of Wisconsin Extension says other invasive species were carried in by ship.
Things like zebra mussels and spiny water fleas, round gobies, a lot of the really big-name invaders came in through ballast water.
It's easy for new species to hitch a ride on smaller boats, too, and spread from one place to another. So to help slow them down, boaters should clean, drain, and dry their boats between waterways. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
Turn out the lights. The party's over. They say that all good things must end. Call it a night. The party's over. And tomorrow starts the same old thing again. What a crazy, crazy party. Never seen so many people laughing, dancing. Look at you, you're having fun. But look at me, I'm almost crying. But that don't keep her love from dying. Misery, cause for me, the party's over. Turn out the lights. The party's over. They say that all good things must end. Call it a night. The party's over. And tomorrow starts the same old thing again. Once I had a love undying. I didn't keep it. Wasn't trying. Life for me was just one party and then another. I broke her heart so many times. Had to have my party wine. Then one day she said, sweetheart, the party's over. Turn out the lights. The party's over. They say that all good things must end. Call it a night. The party's over. And tomorrow starts the same old thing again. And tomorrow starts the same old thing again.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other Friday, we go to Iowa to hang out with Dr. Politics, professor of political science at Iowa State. He's been covering politics for decades. This has got to be, it's got to be the most unbelievable year to not only cover it, but to try to figure out if there's any historical reference that we can be looking at, Stefan, that explains the incredible insanity we're facing now. I mean, Donald Trump is incredibly unique. The pandemic is incredibly unique. We're experiencing climate change that we're even almost trying to ignore. That's also unique. It's just, I feel like all these things are coming together and the synergistic effect is a level of fear and shock and disbelief. And people are looking for leadership. And I'll be honest with you, Stefan, I don't know where they're going to find it because everyone is afraid.
Well, it's true. And Arnie, the problem is the apocalypse doesn't come in little tiny bites over many years. The apocalypse comes all at once. And that's where we are. We are at an apocalyptic tipping point moment. Not just the U.S., but the whole world is embroiled in searching for ways to cope, number one, with this terrible pandemic, which keeps flaring up, even in countries that have done a wonderful job. I mean, there was just an article about Japan. All of a sudden in Japan, they're shutting down a bunch of things because someone went to a nightclub and a bar, and one person going with COVID into a nightclub or a bar can spread it to all the people who are there, who then spread it to all the people that they know. I mean, it's unprecedented in that sense. Donald Trump came to the White House before COVID. We have to remember that. He is not a product of this pandemic. Mm-hmm. He is a product of a United States that is as deeply divided as it has ever been, probably as deeply divided as it was just before the Civil War broke out. And we don't want to face that. We never wanted to face it. We've put off every reform, every change that we should have been making. Our healthcare system, you know, the greatest in the world, has proven to be incredibly fragile, fragmented, understaffed. instead of training doctors and nurses, we are at community college. I'm so critical now of colleges and universities. We are training people in underwater basket weaving instead of nursing. I have a friend whose daughter was admitted to a nursing program, but they can't let her in because they don't have enough slots. But they do have a lot of slots for completely irrelevant, shallow subjects, which were terrific as a choice when everything was normal. But in 2020, in July of 2020, we need to reprogram a lot of things, Arnie, and that's very difficult.
I'm going to say something because you mentioned Japan. I saw that story and it was about a bar. So one of the things I am learning is that there are probably four things that need to happen until we have either a vaccine or we have some kind of medication that really is effective and works, okay? Kind of like what they use right now with HIV, okay? We need either the HIV kind of equivalent drug because they've never gotten a vaccine for that. So that's really what I'm looking for. But given that, mask wearing, social distancing, closing down bars, frankly, permanently until we figure this out, and closing in-person dining. In-person dining and bars turn out to be the most toxic places on the planet. If it's true in Japan that it basically shut it all down and it came back and you can point to a bar, let's be honest, you can live without a bar. You can live without in-person dining. If I have to pay them a check every single month for the next year, that doesn't cost me that much. What does cost me is to see my economy tank because we see the pandemic come back. And I think people have to start doing cost-benefit analysis. And the cost-benefit analysis is, I mean, my goal, for example, with climate change, Stefan, is I want to buy out the coal companies. I want to buy out the fracking companies. I want to buy out the oil. You want to make money? Here's a check. Okay, because what's going to happen is you will continue to destroy my environment. You will continue to sort of increase the sort of footprint of climate change. And it's not worth it to me. It's cheaper for me to buy you out to let you continue. And I think what you just told me about Japan is living proof that bars and in-person dining probably need to shut down until we either have a vaccine or some kind of a treatment. And I am more than willing to have the government cut them a check.
And you have to remember, however, we've been cutting taxes, which means the government doesn't have any money.
I know.
The federal budget deficit and the national debt is exploding in a way that it never has in the history of the United States. We can't buy out anything, Arnie. And until Americans are willing to pay taxes, and especially the wealthy, the 1%, people who have a lot of money, are willing to chip in to make all this happen, we don't have any leeway. We have no leverage, much less than we've ever had. And yet, you don't hear any discussion about how we can increase the flow of revenue to the government. You don't hear that anywhere.
No.
So you can't do anything. The same with states and local governments.
So can I scream?
In Iowa, the state and the local governments are now broke because the businesses are all closed. They're not getting any tax revenue. So they can't do any of the things that we should be doing in response to the emergency that exists. It's just a daunting moment, aren't it?
Well, it is a daunting moment, but let's remind everyone that during this pandemic, as millions and millions of people are losing their jobs, are underemployed, or losing their health insurance, we have created, 28 or 30 new billionaires just in the last 4 months, and the 1% has actually seen their incomes increase by I don't know how many billions of dollars. So let me just remind you, there are people that are suffering, and then there are people that are cashing out. And if there are people that are cashing out, then I'm going after that cash. I'm sorry. What's a billionaire with no country? What's a billionaire with no economy? What's a billionaire with ice trucks full of dead people? What's a billionaire with people, you know, basically losing their lives like crazy? It ain't worth it. And if they think it is, I'm taxing them. To me, it is the immorality of this and the inability to look down the road about the kind of choices we make. They will still be incredibly rich, Stefan, after we tax the hell out of them.
Well, sure, and they always have been. And you have to remember that in the great period of enormous prosperity, the tax rate for wealthy people was 90% and 91%. And they were wealthy as hell. And I've been to Newport, Rhode Island, and I've seen the mansions of people who were taxed very heavily so that you could build roads, so that you could build a healthcare system, so that you could fund national security and defense. And they were fine with it. You know, they also had their little tax shelters and tax attorneys, but they paid a relatively significant amount into the pool from which Americans became middle class and the envy of the world. In 2020, we are no longer the envy of the world. We are the mocking of the world. We are the country that is failing at every level with everything that we're doing. We have been banned. Iowans right now, Arnie, yesterday, Chicago said, if you come from Iowa to Chicago, you have to quarantine for 2 weeks. Wow. Iowa, you know, in Iowa used to be a place, your license plate was golden because it was this nice rural place, a nice place, you know, with the farmers and all this. Now we are an epidemic center where spikes are going up all over the place. We have no mandate for masks. Our governor has said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say, you know, we'll do it in places where there is a sudden outbreak. But she has even prohibited mayors in towns from imposing their own mandates.
I know.
So, you know, we are a country that is disintegrating, frankly. We're disintegrating.
So they're talking about extending unemployment. They're talking, I mean, they're trying to figure out what to do between, I mean, people are going to, if they're evicted during the middle of a pandemic, that doesn't make us more stable. They don't get another unemployment check. They're not going to be able to pay their rent for those that are still paying rent. They're not going to be able to pay the electric bill for those that are still paying the electric bill. I mean, in a way, the government, by sending this money to these unemployed people, the unemployed people aren't sitting on it like the rich are sitting on their billions. The unemployed people are taking every dime that the federal government is sending them, and they're putting it right back into the economy. Can we do the math for people? How stupid is this? Billionaires shelter their billions, hide their billions, don't invest their billions, and these people who are getting these checks are actually paying people so that the rest of us can stay afloat. I mean, there is a cause and effect here, but nobody's explaining it to sort of the general public.
No, that's right. I know it's very parochial for me to be talking about Iowa this much, but Iowa is a small state that should be able to manage these things. There was a Black Lives Matter protest here in Ames, Iowa, university town. Why? Because the city of Ames is suddenly having to start billing people again for their water. Our water plant is very expensive. We have to purify all this Iowa water, which is highly contaminated with nitrates.
Because of fertilizers.
And they had a moratorium on it. So people who didn't have the income didn't have to pay for their water bills. Now they're doing it again. And Black Lives Matter said, my God, you know, we can't afford to pay bills right now. We're unemployed. The economy is stuck.
But it's not a Black Lives Matter. It's a poverty matter. It's an unemployment matter.
There was a big protest. Let me also add one thing that you forgot.
Okay, what I
forgot. Wait till universities open up again, Arnie.
I know.
Till the universities open up again. You talked about bars and shutting them down. Arnie, in Iowa, they had a picture, which I may have sent you, of young people at this lake on their boats. And there were thousands of them with no masks, drinking and having a wonderful time. And so when universities open up again, and I'm right here in my office now at Iowa State University, we have no idea what students are going to do. We have no idea if they're going to behave or not. And so in order to deal with this, I have actually gotten my bottle of antacid. This is Top Care antacid, because I'm going to have to drink this whole bottle of antacid that I'm showing you now in order to survive when all the students flood back in. We've all been issued these black masks with Iowa State University logos on them. We have been told today by experts that big buildings like the one I'm in, which has a centralized air conditioning system, a huge air conditioning system on the roof, spread coronavirus. Because the air conditioning system, if one person in the building has COVID-19, the air conditioning system picks it up and pushes it through the system. We're all vulnerable. This is a horrible discovery for anyone who works in a big building. They said window air conditioners, which only air condition one room at a time, they're okay. Because if you have COVID, you know, you're pushing the air out the window. But if it's a huge building like university,
it's going to the whole building.
We're stuck with all these structures that were built not for this kind of a crisis. It is frightening, and it's truly, I say it's apocalyptic, but you know that's
right,
just
so,
me
so,
because I'm an old guy who's afraid.
Well, so I'm an old woman who's afraid too. So now that us two oldsters are talking to each other, I do think that what may help the university is a decision that was recently rescinded by the administration about foreign students. And I'm gonna share a story with you. Southern New Hampshire University had made a decision weeks ago that they were gonna go all online, completely. And they have a lot of foreign students, a lot. They have marketed their institution in China. So it never occurred to them that this would be an issue for them. And then all of a sudden they came down with that order that you can't have all online because we're going to then send your foreign students back to wherever they came from. Well, MIT filed suit, Harvard filed suit, the Attorney General of Massachusetts filed suit. And I think a lot of businesses went berserk as well because a lot of these people are being trained and interned. So they have now rescinded it. That is a gift for your fear. Because one of the reasons why you needed to actually think about reopening was because just like every other university and college, you have a significant portion of foreign students. And you needed to make sure you didn't lose that income. You didn't send them back. It was all these things. And you needed some kind of elasticity. And this was creating a rigid response as opposed to an elastic response. So I'm glad they rescinded it. But I hear you. I mean, do you shut down every fraternity house? Do you shut down every sorority house? Because almost by definition, they're like the bars. I was just talking about, you know, shutting down every bar and in-person restaurant. Well, I think you need to shut down every fraternity house and every sorority house because they're like the equivalent of a on-campus bar.
And if you do that, nobody's going to go to college because we all go to college in order to be in a fraternity, sorority, social organization. We go to college in order to study, but that's only one piece. The other is to go to football games. The other is to have a social life with people. And with masks and no alcohol and no partying, you might as well stay at home with your parents.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's interesting. So while Trump reverses his position on foreign students, I went to The Hill this morning. I could not believe it. Listen to the headline, everyone. I wasn't even paying attention to this. Top Democrats call for oversight of Trump's demand for review of universities' tax-exempt status.
Yeah.
So let me just say that what is so
they're
interesting.
They're going to punish us.
Yes, they are. So as they are celebrating and giving public money to religious institutions, allowing religious institutions to discriminate, allowing religion to do things that really fly in the face of everything we believe in this country, plus get tax-exempt status, plus get federal dollars, they are now looking at our institutions of higher learning and threatening their tax-exempt status. This is beyond insane.
Unless they open up.
Yes.
I mean, the threat is if you don't open up, you know, the way they're pushing for schools to open up, we're going to punish you. And so you'd better the hell open up. You know, you've got this conflicting message. I mean, I'm going nuts, Arnie. I saw this morning that a group of very distinguished people, knowledgeable people said, yes, we must have our children going back to schools because that is where they learn and where they are socialized and where they are comfortable. And so we can't shut the schools down. Then others are saying, well, you can't open the schools unless you've got a plan. And there is no plan on how to do it without risking the health of children and their families. So you have all these conflicting messages coming And Americans are going, what the hell am I supposed to do?
So, Stefan, one of the things that we heard is that they've been attacking Dr. Fauci for making mistakes. And one of the things we're beginning to realize is that this is a learning process. You heard me say that with Scott Braddock. We're learning on the job because this is a new pandemic. We're trying to figure out how to deal with it. And every time more information comes, it's going to change our behavior because the information is enlightening us, okay?
Yes.
And so as I'm looking at the whole thing about schools, one of the things that really bothers me is that if you're going to open schools, you've got so many issues here. Not only do the issues of the staffing, which obviously, you know, you keep talking about the fact that, well, little tooties don't get this disease or they don't carry the disease, but you know what teachers do? You know, the custodians do, the bus drivers do. And so not only are they not providing people with enough revenue to actually make informed decisions here, but at the same time, suddenly the idea of the technology divide is becoming horrific because we're finding people that have never been able to connect to technology because they can't afford the Comcast bill, they can't afford the internet bill, they don't have a computer. And so kids who went into have-not schools stay in have-not homes. So they lose both ways. Their school system wasn't as quality. And it's almost all the inequality things are really coming back to haunt us in a million ways. And this is just once again exposing it because schools are the best place to show the grotesque level of inequality in America. That and healthcare proves that we have abandoned so many people in this country.
It is also, and this is of interest, a real threat to capitalism because it is a threat to the market economy, to the idea of supply and demand, the idea that job markets and salaries and other things are regulated by an invisible hand that is smart and makes the right decisions and so on. The system isn't working. In Iowa, which is a very prosperous state, agricultural state, we have the largest number of children and families who are deficient in food that we've ever had in the history of the state. And the numbers are so shocking that I'm surprised the governor and the legislature are not ringing the alarm bell and saying, why did this happen? We've got to do something about this. This can't be possible that in Iowa, we are deficient in food and we have to supply people with breakfast and lunch and sometimes even dinner in schools because they can't get it at home. I mean, what the hell kind of country is that? You know, we're not Paraguay. Even in Paraguay, you know, the people have more food, the poor people.
But it's not just capitalism. So let me just say something. So when you go to the Nordic countries, they will describe themselves not as socialists, but as capitalists. Okay, they describe themselves as capitalists, but they're capitalists with an interesting parameter. And that is that they have an active social investment. And that means that you don't lose your job and lose your health care. It's totally disconnected. Healthcare is a separate right. Everybody gets it. In a lot of ways, it's the best thing. If you want to raise the bottom's income, you make sure there's universal healthcare because therefore you don't have to worry about your job to go to a doctor. You don't have to worry about a copay when you go to a doctor. Yeah. You don't have to worry about the cost of the prescription drug when you go to a doctor. That alone changes some of where those little dollars go to. Then you look at wages. I've told you this story before, Stefan, where these guys told me how much they hated me because I loved women on welfare and they hated women on welfare. And I asked, why did they hate women on welfare? And they said, women on welfare get food stamps. We don't. Women on welfare get Medicaid. We don't. Women on welfare get, you know, after school care. We don't. And I said, well, you know what? It doesn't sound like there's something wrong with welfare. It sounds like there's something wrong with work. Why can you work so hard and not be able to go to a doctor when you're sick? Why do you work so hard and not be able to pay for food? That's what's wrong. It's not capitalism. It's that we haven't actually created this idea that people need to be gainfully employed to be able to pay bills. And when you underemploy them, they starve. They fail. They get sick.
There is a thing called laissez-faire capitalism, market economy, which means that the government essentially just lets things happen and steps back and lets the system work as if the natural environment will make things work. And laissez-faire capitalism was abandoned a long time ago but it's come back in the U.S. where we have attacked the government. Ronald Reagan said, you know, the government is not the solution, it's the problem. And the Republicans rode on that, and the Republicans have done a very good job of saying, you know, those Democrats in Iowa right now, we have a race for the Senate. One of the big themes is that the Democrat is going to raise your taxes, that taxes are bad. You shouldn't be paying taxes. You should be paying as little as possible in taxes because government is bad and wastes your money. And it isn't true. Every road that you drive on, except for a few private roads in Texas and Florida that you have to pay to drive on, every road was paved and is maintained by revenue that's generated by fuel taxes or other taxes. Every school is run by taxes that are usually the real estate tax. You know, we have really misinformed and misled people into thinking that government is the problem. In the Scandinavian countries, you have capitalism with a very robust and effective government.
Exactly.
And the two things work hand in hand and help each other.
I started posting now on Facebook that what we need is government control of private power. And what we have right now is private power and basically a skeleton of a government. And the people that are the most active in talking about, you know, don't raise revenue are the billionaires. I mean, I love Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett runs around and talks about the fact that I pay less in taxes than my secretary. So no. When people are talking about don't tax people, you got to start asking, how is it possible that Warren Buffett is paying less than his secretary, when, as you mentioned, Warren Buffett can buy countries, let alone states. So I want people to understand it's not about taxes. It's about what they pay for. And if they pay for something that right now is making it impossible for you to be able to go to a doctor when you're sick, put food on the table, be able to rent an apartment, then maybe that tax is something that you value because it means you can take care of your family. And that's the part that makes me crazy. It's going to be so interesting, I think, Stefan, as we go into this 2020 election. The Democrats are pumped. Here's my problem. If they get into power, what the frick do they do? And which master do they genuflect to? Do they genuflect to what we're seeing with this pandemic, what we're going to see with climate change, or are the billionaires, the private power, the banks that own this place, you know, the health insurance companies and the big pharma that own this place, are they going to own them or are the people going to? It's going to be so
interesting. An interesting point you make, if you're a Democrat, do you really want to win this election at this moment? Or do you want to let the Republicans try to figure out how to claw our way out of it? Because this is not easy. Even if a Democrat gets elected, coronavirus doesn't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. It's not going to say, oh, you know, I'm going away because Joe Biden got elected. Goodbye.
And I need to let you go. Stefan Schmidt is known as Dr. Politics. He teaches political science at Iowa State. He joins us every other week. Of course, this is Friday, and this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott, my great producers. Talk to you next week. Ciao.